lived in Madison since 1962, and obviously I've just come to very much love this city and care about it. And while I've been in out of office, it hasn't made any difference as to my paying attention to what's going on. We've always had very strong neighborhoods in Madison, very vibrant, very active neighborhoods. And as part of my interest in neighborhoods, I've more or less studied them, looked at them around the country, tried to see what works. And a lot of people in this little short election season have asked me, what's your vision for the future? And my vision for the future, at least as it relates to what I'd like to share with you, is actually to go backwards. And I'd like to spend about 5 minutes just telling you about how some things came to be. When I was elected in 1989, about 2 weeks later, Joe Ballas, who was a sergeant, maybe a patrol officer at the time, was assigned as the community officer to the Broadway-Simpson neighborhood. And he wrote me a handwritten letter, and in it he said, I'm a community police officer, I'm here at Broadway-Simpson, I'm well trained both in law enforcement and community work. And then he concluded by saying, what am I doing here? It's a rather profound question if you think about it. And I have a habit, give me a large enough desk, I try and keep it clean, but anything that's outstanding sits in one corner of the desk. And that note sat there for several weeks because I couldn't figure out a response. And I thought about his letter, and after a period of time, I came to realize what the problem was. He was there all alone. He's a police officer, his job is law enforcement, which is basically to control crime, but he's not building anything. He's not connected to people who are building things in the neighborhood. That then led to some discussions with some other city staff, and out of that came what came to be called the neighborhood resource teams. We created about a dozen of them, and they were very carefully placed. They covered areas as small as 200 to 300 to as large as about 1,200. And we set up a dozen of them. They were police officers, firefighters, public health nurses, housing specialists, people who knew job training, traffic engineers for lighting around neighborhoods, building inspectors. There were about 10, 11 different professions, librarians. And we eventually hooked up with the schools, but they were staff teams that came together to do two things. First, to meet among one another and discuss what their challenges were and how they were going to serve the neighborhood. And the second thing they did is they then interacted with the neighborhood association, with institutions in the neighborhood. They may have been religious or social, businesses. And we eventually had about 120 people serving on these neighborhood resource teams. About a year or two later, after we'd implored the county to get involved, the county did. The county started providing a social worker to go with the neighborhood resource teams. And at that point, our team started reporting back saying that they felt that their effectiveness had increased 10 times, 100 times, because the county social worker had certain skills that our other city staff did not have. And now they were really working as a team. And by the mid-1990s, I think we just saw some real significant reversals. The results were, in some instances, greater and greater private sector involvement. That's what happened at Durer Court. That's what happened at Broadway-Simpson. That's what happened in a number of areas. And while there's never been any scientific studies, one of the things we saw, because the best measurement for poverty in the community, the best measurement we've got is the number of kids in the free and reduced lunch program in the schools. And that number had grown to 27%. And from about 1995 up and through about 1993 to about 2003, 2004, 2005, that number held steady at 27%. In other words, a number that had been constantly rising for 15 years suddenly was flattened out and it held solid. I left office. I apologize for that. The neighborhood resource teams were changed. Somebody had this bright idea. They said, well, if the neighborhood resource team's such a good idea, why don't we make them citywide? So they reduced the number to 5, and then each 5 neighborhood resource teams cover a population of the city of about 40,000. Well, it was the same name, but it missed the whole point, which was to very intensely go into an area, become support for the neighborhood, and help turn things around. Balance off the law enforcement with the community development aspects of it. It obviously had some effect on the attitude of the city staff, because where we used to convene quarterly, the teams would meet among them, or each team by itself would meet, depending on its own routine, weekly or every other week. Then area teams would meet quarterly. And then twice a year, we would bring everybody together. And we used to have over 100, 110 people attending these meetings. We'd have a retreat at Old Brick Garden Center. We'd start at 8 in the morning. We'd go to 11 o'clock. Then we'd break out lunch, and that would give people time to informally discuss what was going on. Nowadays, when they have these meetings, 30 to 50 city employees show up, which tells me that they've lost interest, that they're not engaged. But more importantly, the teams really aren't focused. One of the things that I'm committed to do is to re-engage the teams, get them really focused on the areas that need the attention the most, and focus on building up the neighborhoods. Building up everything, like the key areas are these: transportation, housing, child care, which covers a whole range of things, to after school and summer rec programs. Let me start over. Housing, transportation, child care, health, and then the education job training component. And I would add one more agenda item. That additional agenda item would be financial literacy. In this day and age, it appears that managing finances, dealing with problems of money, is more critical than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago. So that's one of the type of things that I'd like to see happen. I know that there's been some renewed commitments in the area, and I guess I'd really like to reinforce those and build them up. That's what I think is the job of the city. So, you want to talk about other things? Overture, snow removal, taxes. I'd be more than happy to share time on those as well.
So. I guess one of my main questions is how you see yourself outside of what you just said about those committees is different from our current mayor.
Well, I think that's pretty significant.
I'm not saying that it's not.
I mean, it's a whole approach and it's a whole attitude. But there's other things. Well, let's start with what I think is primary. To build a strong community, whether we like it or not, it has to be built on a solid financial base. It means that there has to be revenues coming in to pay for the services. And we're not doing it. We've done some analysis and we've studied the new construction and investment in our community, looking particularly at the last 5 years. And we've got a good way of studying it, which is to look at the relationship to the rest of Dane County. And when you look at Madison and Dane County going back 25, 30 years, it's a pretty consistent pattern of a ratio of construction and investment in the city versus the rest of the county. About 5 years ago, we started getting a significant divergence. And if you look at that divergence, If you don't mind, I'll just show you here. I mean, say this would represent the county, and this would represent the city, and there's, over the last 15, 20 years, there's always been slightly more investment in the county as opposed to the city. And I deliberately made this a little bit wider, because as the years have gone by, there's always a little bit more in the county. And then we get to 2005, and the county goes like this, and then it goes like this. That's the city. And actually, I should make this wider. And if you take, if you'd had the city follow the same pattern as the county, the difference is $1.5 billion. I think the anecdotes of hearing somebody like Gary Gorman saying, I'm not doing business in the city anymore, or a developer coming up to me saying, you folks in Madison have a different way of doing business. I think that's true. I think the anecdotes have translated into reality, and we're not getting the kind of private investment we need. The private investment for the jobs, the private investment for the housing, the private investment for the commercial, and that is what pays the bills. That's what pays the bills that then allows us to deal with snow removal, salaries for city staff, parks maintenance, dealing with issues related to community services. So I think the first thing that a mayor has to do is focus on bringing together people who want to invest in our community and the neighborhoods. And they have something in common. What they have in common is an affection for the city and a desire to see this be a great place to live. But for some reason, things have gone astray in the last 8 years. The Edgewater is a perfect example. I mean, we've been at it for 2 years, and we still haven't seen a shovel turned on the construction. We spent 8 years. When I ran in 03, the library was an issue. And we've seen three different variations of it, and we're on a fourth now. Then there's all the private development that hasn't taken place. And I would add one more thing to it, which is the instability of city staff. The departure recently of Tim Cooley is a perfect example. I teach graduate courses in management, and other than Professor Driesang, I'm the only one at the university who's taught graduate courses in public personnel practices. I think I know something about the subject. There is absolutely no reason to put a department or division head who's newly hired on 2 years probation. None. If you have properly vetted and properly examined the background of the individual who's going to have 6 to 10, 12 years or more in the public sector, that individual will have given you enough experience in terms of their ability to budget and things of that sort that you don't need to spend a year and a half to see whether or not they can write a budget. I've got graduate students who are not accountants that 2 years at the La Follette School of Public Affairs and give them 2 years in the field, they can do a budget. When you do that, what happens, and it was in an article in In Business Magazine that came out this week, when you do that, you discourage the very finest people from applying. They're going to say, what? I'm going to come for 2 years and be on probation? And if I make it through probation, within another 3 years, I'm subject to have my entire contract reviewed? The best people don't apply. I happen to believe, and this is a debate that goes back 150 years, our bureaucrats, and I use that word in a positive sense, are bureaucrats working for the government, or are they working for the chief executive? I think they're working for the government. which means they're working for the other elected officials besides the mayor or the county executive or the governor. It means that they are freer to answer questions and to participate in debate and to express themselves. The only reason I can think of to have a public employee at a department division head level who's on 2 years probation is to keep them chained, shackled, and gagged, to keep them from expressing themselves. And I don't think that's necessary. And we saw this reflected in another comment that differentiates the mayor and myself on the question of public employees speaking. We have no rules when I was mayor about public employees speaking. The only thing we ask is that they know what they're talking about. You know, I mean, know what the subject is, know why the decision was made if you're going to question it in public. So I think those are our differences between Dave and myself.
I guess what my question is to you is, how do you see, because you said the importance of the neighborhoods, how do you see neighborhood plans and the comprehensive plan of the city when they're in conflict being resolved, and what role does the mayor's office have and the city council have in issues of that sort?
I'm very big on process, and I can't give you a specific answer in that specific instance. I think there's some realities we have to deal with. One of which is, if we don't want sprawl, we need greater density. We as Madisonians say all the time we don't want sprawl. Well, we're gonna have to deal with the issue of density then. So that's one thing. The second thing is, the ultimate decision is made by the elected officials, the city council. They are the only ones that are voted by the public into office to make the decisions. We get conflicts within neighborhoods, between neighborhoods all the time. I mean, I've lived through some monstrous ones, the Atwood Avenue bypass, which, you know, the Willie Street neighborhood, Jennifer Spade Street neighborhood, versus the other side of East Washington, versus all the people on the other side of Lake Monona. I mean, you know, you had about six different sides to that debate. And not everyone is going to get everything they want. What I think is really critical is that there be a fair process for discussion. And I'll get to the mayor's role in a second. There has to be good resources from the staff, technical resources from planning and transportation, so we know the options and we know the consequences of what we're doing, so we don't get a whack-a-mole situation where you take care of a transportation problem here and you create another one over there, or you move an area that's very troubled and the folks disperse and it creates another problem over here. The role of the mayor is I want to go back to the process now. The mayor's role is to guide. The mayor's role is to make sure this does not become an endurance contest of the last person standing. That's not what democracy is about.
That sounds like the Edgewater.
Well, that's where I'm going to, is the Edgewater. And I'd like to describe what went wrong with the Edgewater and how I would have handled it differently. Where the mayor made a mistake is that, maybe because of his need to show that he was pro-business and wanted to see a good development go forward, he embraced the specific design that Hammes Corporation and Bob Dunn came in with. When he embraced that specific design, two things went wrong. First is, he preempted the neighborhood. That's the first thing that happened. And the second thing that happened is, he sent a message to the developer that since the mayor supported the specific design, that the developer wasn't going to need to make any compromises. After all, the mayor supported the project. Well, then what happens is this protracted, very bloody debate that goes on, and very frankly, you know, here we are 2 years later, no results. The best thing that I ever experienced was the State Street Mall, and that is the way a process ought to work. Now, what happened there was we set an objective to do the State Street Mall. We hired what we thought was the best architectural firm for the job, M. Paul Freeburg and Associates. They had come in with a design and concepts so we could get a feel for what it would look like. Once we hired them, we had a meeting with them, and I said to them, where's your design? And they said, oh, we're putting that away. That's not relevant now. That was to show you what was possible. So what's going on here? And I said, well, now we're going to go down to State Street, and we're going to have a series of meetings with the neighbors, the residents, the property owners, the visitors, the students who are there all the time, the people who come down once a month, and we're going to try and find the people who don't like to come to State Street. And from that, they started a process of listening to what people wanted in terms of the State Street Mall. Then they did their design. It was their design. The city had to pay for it. But there was this listening process that took place first. That process does not have to take 6 years. It doesn't have to take 6 months. But the point is that the role of the mayor is to, in effect, welcome the concept and then send people on their way to work on the design, work on the development. And the mayor's job is to make sure that the staff is professional, the staff is available, and that the process keeps moving so that we're not there for 18 years. So on the particular project, I don't know that I'd have an opinion.
Well, I wasn't asking you for opinion per se, but there is a balance between neighborhood plans and the city's comprehensive plan. And what I heard at that meeting from a city planning staff person was that neither one trumps the other, but you know, if this is the way the developer wants it, this is the way it's going to have to be. And it seemed to me that it was kind of like a take it or leave it kind of a position. And I was a little taken aback by the person from the city planning department that said that, and the fact that the neighborhood association felt very strongly that they did everything right. They spent $4,000 to develop this neighborhood plan and got it approved, and it was unanimous, and it was the best one that ever came down the pike according to the city council. And then they were told, your plan is be damned, and you know.
And I'd like to learn how that plan, both plans evolved,
right,
the nature of the conflict.
Right.
I'd like to learn a whole lot more.
I'm just saying that there's these ultimate conflicts, and neighborhoods do have a say. And I know in the case of the Edgewater, there were several different neighborhood associations. One that was developed as the process went along, and one that had been established there for a long time, and they were in conflict. So.
Yeah. And let me just say, one of the problems with the city right now, I believe, is we are doing too much without first having a plan. Yes, sir.
Speaking of lack of planning, one of the reasons why the average income in Madison is decreasing is because certain people on the city council have never met a low-income project that they didn't like. And they'll put them any place at any time, and if possible, make them nonprofit so the property goes off the property taxes at the same time. Would you bring some sort of planning so that we don't overload certain neighborhoods with high-need people and overwhelm the school in the neighborhood with high-need children?
It's an interesting question, and I'm kind of revisiting it in my own mind right now. First of all, we have housing needs of this in this community at all sorts of income levels. It's not just a question for families that cannot sustain themselves, but one of the things that deeply concerns me is that we've got working families, two income families that together are making $60,000-$70,000 a year, and they are leaving the city because they cannot find adequate housing. What costs $250,000 in Sun Prairie is going to cost at least $350,000 here in Madison. So we've got to address that issue. One of the things that we've done over the years, and it's generally recognized as the best thing to do, is to try and do scattered site housing in terms of all income levels. And generally, it's come from the city into the neighborhoods. And what I'm curious about is what would happen, going back to neighborhood plans, if we were to start planning at the neighborhood level to get economic mixes, and that as part of that, there would be assurances that there'd be certain support services, the kind I just discussed. One of the things that got me in trouble in 2003 on the housing issue was this, and people didn't like when I said this. I said, imagine that you've got a lifeboat. A lifeboat has a legal capacity of 15 people. We've got 18 people in the lifeboat right now. There's another 15 in the water. At what point do we have to make the hard, very difficult moral decision not to bring the rest of the people into the boat? Because otherwise the whole boat will go under. In other words, there's a capacity issue here. And one of the things I tried to do in my previous tenure as mayor was to match up the various needs that I just outlined. In other words, if somebody is doing housing and they are attempting to create affordable housing, are they ensuring that the tenants have adequate resources for transportation to get to a job? Have they hooked up with an agency that's supposed to be bringing job, to bring employment and job training to the neighborhood? Or are they just isolated? In other words, we're just going to house and just warehouse people. Because I find that unacceptable. I find it, and let me tell you about a visit to, and I'll end with this, with a professor I went to visit at Northwestern University. He had studied the migration of low-income families from Chicago into the suburbs. And he found greater success academically and economically for the families. And we were discussing the dynamics of movement and all this other stuff. And at one point, he just kind of stopped and he said, look, there's one thing you cannot allow. You cannot allow the conditions that the families left to be duplicated in the place to which they move. If that happens, you've not done them a service, and you haven't done the existing residents a service. And I think that's a point to be well taken. One more last thing. I've got your email. Mary Berryman Agard and I wrote a report after 3 years of study that we published early last fall. We looked only at the Park Street area. We contained our study area to Park Street. But we wanted to look to see what makes a difference in terms of successful employment. What are the components you have to bring together? We have an electronic version of it. I'll send it to you, and then you can send it to whoever wants to read it. It's about 50, 60 pages long. We were funded by the EVU Foundation, MG&E, American Transmission, Midwest Family Broadcasting, the Madison Community Foundation. I think we did good work. We made recommendations for the city and the county. If I'm mayor, I think I have an obligation to help implement some of those recommendations that the city needs to do.
Is
this copy of that report available on your website, do you know?
It's not.
Okay.
It's not.
You know what, if you want to just write down your email address.
Would it be possible for you to send it out on the Orchard Ridge listserv as well when you receive it?
Oh, are you in Orchard Ridge?
Yes.
You know what, I'll send it to Becky Jen.
Becky Jen, yes, please.
So I'll send it.
I just have a question. Governor Walker has talked about the hammer coming down. At the last CCOC meeting, we had the city lobbyist in to talk about what we're going to expect in terms of shared revenue payment for municipal services.
Yes.
So I've been told, you know, what we think is the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
We need to double it. What? If you...
I've been there, done that.
Well, what I'm just saying is, I'm just saying, this is like almost a perfect storm coming. I think a lot of people don't understand...
Yes.
The tools in the toolbox that Walker is going to give us are in terms of employees. So if you're faced with not being able to raise taxes above what you're allowed, and you have no money, I mean, you're not getting our revenue stream in.
And if we fix this, it'll still take 3 to 5 years to start generating taxes.
What are you, what would you be prepared to cut? Police and fire?
I'm not going to. I'm not going to.
You're not going to cut any of the basic services? I mean,
let me explain something. When I was mayor in the 90s, we faced greater cuts than are faced now. The reason is this. At that point, for example, we were receiving $25 million in shared revenue. We were losing 5% a year. 5% of 25 million is a lot of money. 5% of 5 million is really small. We've lost so much shared revenue. Now, a couple of different approaches that I want to take on this. First, other Wisconsin cities are going to be hurt far worse than we are because we are so less dependent on shared revenues. And the irony of it is, I used to say in the 90s, one of these days the rest of the state's going to catch up with us and the other cities are going to start screaming. Well, took a long time, but maybe we're there. So one of the things that needs to be done is we have to build alliances with all the other cities in the state. That, I think, is critical. And people have to understand that it's our money. And the reason I say that is Wisconsin is very different than other states in how taxes are collected. Blame Bob LaFollette on this. Bob LaFollette's idea was you collect the vast majority of taxes at the state level, and then you redistribute them based on need to the municipalities and school districts. So when the state's talking about its largesse in giving us these shared revenues, from Madison's standpoint, end all the shared revenue programs. Give us the tax systems that you've got in Missouri, Oklahoma, most of the states in the country. Give the city the ability to levy some of these sales taxes and income taxes. Take it away from the state, and we'll be far better off. And that's one of the issues that I intend to raise. Building alliance with the other municipalities is another. And then we're going to have to bring the city agencies together and figure out how we're going to live with whatever problem, however deep the problem is. Here I go back to the quality efforts we had, which were started by Mayor Sensenbrenner in the 80s. Which I was very skeptical about when I was elected in 89, and which were very effective. This city, to this day, would have been spending millions of dollars more for the same level of services, but not for the fact that we put this quality system together, this different management approach. And it's been gone over the last 10 years. It's time to bring it back. And again, we may not get immediate savings, but I'll just give you one example. We were wasting almost $600,000 a year in garbage collection because of the garbage trucks queuing up to unload at the central tipping point before they return to go out into the streets. The engineers and the managers for years couldn't figure out how to deal with it. They assembled a team of the garbage truck drivers and the supervisors who worked at the tipping station. They came in with a different schedule, a different route system. It ended the backlog of trucks lining up, dozens of trucks every day for 20 minutes to an hour. And you can imagine what kind of efficiency. It ended up saving $600,000 a year. It's a very simple concept. You get the people who do the work to try to figure out how to do it better. It means managers surrendering authority. It works. So I'm not willing to accept that we're going to have to cut services.
Back to the graph that you drew on the wall behind you. What did the county do differently to generate revenue?
And nothing.
Particularly, so it's just luck.
It's the fact that developers simply said, we're not going to build in Madison. We're going to build in Middleton. We're going to build in Sun Prairie.
So they weren't choosing outer-lying communities as much as they were choosing not to develop in Madison.
Yes. Okay. I mean, there's just no question about that. I mean, you've got Gary Gorman who came right out and said it. I've got another developer who's a personal friend of mine who's made it very clear that he's done doing business in Madison. At least he has been for the last decade. And I went to a Brewer game. I'll give you another example. I went to a Brewer game last summer, long before I thought of running for mayor. Ran into the cousin of a friend who is a big developer in the Chicago area. He said, for years I've wanted to do business in Madison. It's a wonderful city. My son's going to the university. I've got a lot of ideas. You folks have your own way of doing business there. We're not interested.
Is it regulation primarily, or is it just roadblocks or maybe?
It's the reputation that it takes forever to get something done. And by the way, this developer has come into Wisconsin. He's done work in the Kenosha area, and he's very happy with it, and they're happy with him.
What are your thoughts on the city buying real estate like East Washington Avenue?
Don't you want to go home?
I do, it's the last one.
We're stuck with it, okay? There's two things wrong with it. One, I can't understand why the city would buy land when a private party is interested in buying it. Secondly, you end up taking it off the tax rolls. Thirdly, it now increases your debt service for your capital budget, which now jeopardizes your AAA bond rating. And why don't I add to your question, why did the city pay so much money for the Villager Mall? I mean, the idea of putting social services in the Villager was mine. I haven't been in office since 97. It was not my idea to spend $3 to $4 million more for the Villager than it was worth. That's a short answer. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. Remember, next Tuesday is primary day. Polls are open from 7 in the morning till 8 o'clock at night.
No primary.
No, I mean for the mayor.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's technically five of us.
Okay, so I wanted to know.
And we want to do real well.